Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food and Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week we're talking about cooking with leftovers in mind, picnics, and some changes we're making to our cookbook club. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. How about that LA Times story on the importance of recipe testing?
It was fascinating to hear their process.
Can you sum it up for us?
So this article in the LA Times talked about how they test recipes exhaustively there, but that in our culture, the practice of recipe testing is something that is perhaps diminishing because as other food sections go out of business or, you know, there's been the rise of the food blog, there's not always the same level of scrutiny that other people are putting on the recipes they put out there. And so they gave an example of when they were working on a focaccia recipe with Nancy Silverton at Mazza and how they tested it 40 or 50 times to get
43 it. 43 times, they said.
Yes, 43 times precisely to get it right because they were using different flour in a home kitchen than she uses in the restaurant. And so trying to make that transition and create something that was satisfying.
Now, I have tested recipes for magazines and books and my own purposes, and I've never tested a recipe 43 times. Have you?
No.
What would you say is the most?
I have probably tested something no more than 6 times to get it right, and that's pretty rare. You know, I feel like 1 to 3 is sort of standard for my world.
I agree with that, 1 to 3. I would say that I think I max out, you know, obviously with the Zahav book, there was so much intense testing, maybe some things were tested 10 times.
Yeah.
But that's the most that I have ever done. And to I think about how crazy I was at that point. And to think about doing that 4 times as much, I almost can't even. However, I'm sure there's like a staff of people in the test kitchen, which sort of makes it probably a better experience.
Well, yeah. And when it's a test kitchen rather than your own home kitchen, I feel like the resources are better. So you don't have to worry as much about, oh God, where am I going to put this in the refrigerator? Mm-hmm. There's a budget that the ingredients are coming from. So it's not that you're just sort of whittling down at your own food budget to do right. the testing.
And then, of course, there's the chores, just like the drudgery, the mm-hmm. shopping and cleaning up that is definitely not my favorite part of the recipe process.
True enough. Although I have found that thanks to things like Instacart, if you are on a time crunch for the ingredient sourcing, there mm-hmm. is always – you can always order them and have them delivered.
Have you had good luck with Instacart?
I've done okay.
I feel like they're always picking out like the crappiest thing in the vegetable bin, like the thing that no one else would pick up if they were shopping for themselves.
I feel like I've had pretty good luck with Instacart. We also recently, just as an experiment, used Amazon Fresh to order groceries.
I haven't even heard of that.
And if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can try it, I think, once, like a 30-day trial, and then it's something like $300 a year to have access to it, which is a lot of money for grocery delivery. Mm-hmm. But the quality was really good.
That's interesting.
And so I don't think we're going to keep it up simply because I like to grocery shop. But though, you know, if you were someone who did a lot of home recipe testing and didn't always have time to source right. your ingredients, it is an option. And I also feel like with Instacart, you want to make sure that they know that they can call you. And the mm-hmm. the best luck I've had with Instacart is when they call me and say, okay, I'm standing in the produce aisle. What, you know, how right. much of this are you looking for?
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't always do that. And so it just depends on the person.
True. The other thing I wanted to touch on in this article was they talked about citizen testers.
Yeah.
I believe it was Hank Shaw, who is a blogger and cookbook author. And he talked about having people volunteer to test his recipes sort of like in the wild as mm-hmm. a potential reader would be doing. And I know that you do that.
I have done that, yeah.
I have served as a citizen tester for some people, although I guess as a cookbook author, I'm probably not the ideal citizen tester. And I also get emails. I'm on Cook's Illustrated's list mm-hmm. for like home cook testers. And, yeah. You know, they basically send you the recipe, then you complete their survey and send it back. And I think that's a really great idea. I think that really helps. What's your take on that?
I think it works really well. So I've done it some with my books. And the hardest part about that is simply the coordination. As a, you know, a lone person who's, you know, frantically trying to pull all of the, you know, the manuscript together and get mm-hmm. the recipes out there, giving yourself enough time to do a thorough testing with citizen testers can often be mm-hmm. hard.
Yeah.
But it's worth doing. I know Maggie Batista, when she did her book Food Gift Loves, had this massive citizen tester brigade, and I feel like that made that book so much better.
Right.
And she had someone helping her coordinate it. So
interesting.
But it's an issue in this world where the access to food media has sort of become more democratized, which is great, but mm-hmm. it also means that what's out there is not always trustworthy.
That is true.
And it's funny, my mother has this habit of just Googling recipes and trying whatever looks good to her.
Oh, my mother does that too.
And it makes me crazy because I'm always like, you can't just pick stuff up off the internet and not, you know, if you don't know the blog right. or you don't know where it's coming from.
And my mom's kitchen skills are not super strong. And I think it just makes the situation worse when yeah. she makes something that doesn't really turn out. And she thinks that it's because of her bad cooking skills, but it's really because of a bad untested recipe.
Yeah. So it is, yeah, for the people who don't have that sort of culinary know-how or instincts about a recipe and they're just following it because it's what it tells you to do and then it doesn't turn out well, that can be really demoralizing and disruptive.
My advice is, if you don't know which recipes are more reliable, ask like a food person in your yeah. life, you know, they know.
And they might have the recipe to send you, you know, if That's you're looking for something like, you know, a really great chicken soup and you're just going to pluck a recipe off the internet, perhaps ask someone and right. Let them guide you. So speaking of looking for things to make for dinner, let's talk a little bit about one of my favorite styles of cooking, which is the plan for intentional leftovers.
That is like a bedrock strategy for me.
It is the best thing ever. So if this sounds like a confusing concept to you, it's essentially when you cook, there are a couple ways to approach it. You're either cooking one thing with the intention of having it last a couple of nights, or you are cooking one night with the intention of putting some of it aside for it to become something else the next night.
Right.
So do you have some favorite strategies for this?
Yeah. I mean, I try to cook intentionally for leftovers a couple of times every week, especially on Sundays.
Yeah.
I'm going through like a very hectic deadline crazy time right now. And so there's no way I'm making something on Sunday that I can't also eat on Monday.
Yeah.
And last night I made it's actually a recipe I recommend a lot. Nom Nom Paleo's lemongrass and coconut chicken.
Ooh, I haven't made that one.
In the Instant Pot. Uh-huh. You know, I was thinking about you. I'm a huge Nom Nom Paleo fan.
Yes.
And I know that your husband prefers a low-carb style.
It is true.
So I think that you should make more of her recipes. They're really good. And
I'll try
particularly this one. I mean, you know how a lot of those sort of Southeast Asian-inspired recipes get spicy? There's like no heat in this.
That would make a big difference
anyway,
for us.
Yeah. But of course, I used like 12 drumsticks, which was even two more than the recipe called for, mm-hmm. because I wanted to be sure to have plenty of leftovers.
Makes sense.
But it is a good idea to sort of prep things to be a component later on down the line, mm-hmm. like brown rice. I often make a big batch of brown rice.
Yeah.
How about you?
I do things like I'll cook extra chicken thinking, okay, so tonight we're just going to have like roast breasts and thighs, and then tomorrow I'm going to turn them into a salad or make some sort of quick chicken soup. Or I will often roast vegetables. So one night we're going to have roasted vegetables, and then the next night I'm going to, you know, and then I put aside one third of them intentionally, thinking that the next night I'm going to make like a quinoa salad or something, and I want to include sort of cold roast vegetables in that. So I do try to think forward like that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like the things that I make where I'm saying, okay, I'm making a big batch of this so that we can eat it two or three times this week. Turkey chili is one of my standards. I did that recently where I knew I was going to have a busy week. And so I made a big pot and it was there when Scott got home from work and I was out teaching in class. He ate it that night. I ate it when I got home. We had it for dinner the next night. And then he took what remained for lunch the next day. So it's sort of, that is my ideal cooking situation.
Yeah, I have a green chicken chili that I sort of press into service that way.
Yeah.
For sure.
Other things, I mean, I make one of the ones I love is to do a sausage, kale, and white bean soup and mm-hmm. treat it that same way. And these are all the same sorts of things that are good for the freezer. But
do you do that in the summer too? I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. I tend to like really let go of soup in the summer.
I don't do a ton of soup. My favorite soup for summertime is to saute like onions and red peppers and eggplant and zucchini, all the sort of, you know, abundant, sort of like a ratatouille soup. Mm-hmm. Tomatoes, and then simmer it all together and then push it through a food mill. So mm-hmm. it's not pureed,
right.
but it's sort of like a chunky smooth, and then top it with Parmesan cheese.
That sounds really
and
good.
And you can eat it hot or at room temperature, and it's delicious. And it's one of those that gets better after a few days. Mm-hmm. And it's also a great way to sort of just use up an abundance of those summertime vegetables. Like Scott doesn't love zucchini, but if it's incorporated into this slurry of a soup, he doesn't object to it.
Can I like take a little digression here?
Yeah.
About zucchini.
Yes.
Have we talked spiralizers on this show before?
I don't think we have.
I love a zoodle, you know, uh-huh. a zucchini noodle.
Yeah.
And I had a julienne peeler that I was using to make zoodles.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I bought OXO's handheld zoodler.
Yeah.
It is the best. It's so small. It takes up no space in the cabinet.
Yeah.
And I have actually been zoodling for leftovers.
Oh.
Because, you know, one night last week we had meatballs from the freezer and mm-hmm. I had them on top of zoodles, but I made too many zoodles, so I put them in the fridge, and then I had ready to go zoodles for like a peanut salad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with like a peanut sauce and mm-hmm. some sesame. So, because I didn't think that you could save zoodles for some reason, but then I noticed at Whole Foods they've been selling them wrapped under cellophane.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was like, if Whole Foods can hold zoodles, so can I. And they do hold up pretty well.
That's interesting. So another small digression here that this makes me think. So I haven't seen the zoodles, but the other thing that I saw recently at Trader Joe's in the prepared food section was prepared cauliflower rice.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know.
Same idea.
Yeah, same thing. Like just cauliflower pulsed in a food processor.
Do you guys like that?
Not really.
I don't really like it either.
If I'm going to eat cauliflower, I either want to roast it so it gets all caramelized mm-hmm. or I'm going to puree it. Those are my two sort of cauliflower or soup.
Plus, you know how I feel about rice, white rice. You're not going to pull one over on me with cauliflower.
It's true.
But, oh, and just like one final digression.
Yes.
You know, white rice I consider a guilty pleasure,
mm-hmm.
but there's newish research on white rice where if – and this applies also to pasta and potatoes. Have you uh-huh. read this? You cook your rice and then you chill it and then you can reheat it to serve or whatever. But the chilling process turns a lot of the starch in there, the starch that would increase your blood sugar, drive insulin production, into resistant starch, which is a prebiotic – that you don't digest, and it cuts the calories by as much as 25%, and it gives the good bacteria in your stomach something to eat.
Fascinating.
So I've been trying to always cook ahead and then cool.
Interesting.
To get the resistant starch. Wow, this segment got wildly off track.
Well, if you have anything that you like to make as sort of your intentional leftovers, we would love to hear about them.
Definitely. Okay, let's talk picnics.
Yes, it is
summer
picnic
is here.
Season.
What's your strategy? Do you like a picnic? How many times a year do you picnic?
I love a picnic. I don't picnic as much as I think about picnicking. I wish I picnicked more. I think that this summer should be the summer of picnics because
I
really enjoy them. And I do have, you know, a picnic basket that I love to pull out. I do. I have like a vintage style old school
picnic basket. That is the cutest
thing
I've ever heard.
Most of the time I use it to hold mason jar lids and rings, mm-hmm. but I empty it out on occasion to take it on a real picnic. And I love it.
And what is your real or fantasy picnic fare?
I think my fantasy picnic fare are things that you would find in like, you know, old school books about people, you know, in the early 1900s or something. So like cold roast chicken and apples and maybe some sort of cookie or something. But in reality, my picnic food is typically a sandwich, you know, or a grain salad that can be doled out. Or I love a salad of chickpeas and grape tomatoes cut in half and red mm-hmm. onion with like a basic balsamic vinaigrette.
There is sort of the issue of, you know, if you're going to spread out a blanket, it's a little hard to juggle lunch
yes.
spread out on a blanket. So a lot of those types of things really lend themselves to eating that way. You mm-hmm. obviously don't want something with like a knife and fork
no.
that you have to chop up. I mean, my reality picnic is like a day where I'm feeling really cooped up in the house and like I want to get out. So, and this is the picnic with a decidedly urban flavor. I go to, you know, the artisan boulanger and buy one of their fabulous tofu banh mi's.
Oh, yeah.
And then like eat it in this little park that they built on East Passaic Avenue. And
Sounds nice.
That's my real picnic.
Yeah.
It's like not romantic. It's just me. I have like sriracha mayo dripping down my arm. But that's the picnic that I really take. My fantasy picnic, I think, would have like, what is that French tuna sandwich where they, I think you make it in advance. It's got like.
Oh, yeah. Pan bagné or something.
Yeah. And it's like oil-packed tuna, maybe, I think maybe even anchovies, capers, and you press it so that it sort of becomes like one thing with the bread. And then the next day you picnic with it. I would say that is my fantasy picnic fare.
I love that. Yeah, I feel like I have a lot more fantasy picnic fare than I actually have reality picnic fare.
Right.
But I do.
But there's no reason that I couldn't make that happen. Like, that is not hard. That just requires one day's notice for, and I can take it to my same little urban park.
It's true.
Or meet you in a park, you know.
We should picnic this summer, Joy.
Yes, All right. We should. Do you have any other fantasy picnic fare?
I love the idea of sort of just on an evening, on a summer evening, saying, let's just take our dinner outside. And that is something that when I was a kid, we used to do. We used to live across the street from a park. And so there would be times when, you know, we just go take our plates and sit outside. And I love that idea. And I live a block and a half from Rittenhouse Square, and I never do something like that.
You know what else you're nearer to than me? Schuylkill Banks.
Yeah.
Is that like a picnic place?
It is. A lot of people in the summer will go out there with blankets, and you'll see groups of people picnicking. When I was in my early and mid-20s, I used to organize a group of the Unitarian young adults here in Philly. And once a month, we had a potluck. And in the summer months, we would turn it into a potluck picnic. And one of the best places I found for picnicking in Philly was up right off the Schuylkill River, like the Boathouse Row, but Lemon Hill up that way. There are picnic tables up there. And if you get to them early enough, it's just a first come, first serve situation. And we would go up there with, you know, like 20 young adults from the Unitarian Church and just spread out. We'd bring a grill and everybody would cook and share salads and stuff. It was really fun.
Before we leave this topic, I want to say in my fantasy picnic, though never in reality for me, there's always like a sparkling wine involved.
Yes.
I don't even know if it's legal to drink a bottle of sparkling wine outside in Philadelphia, but...
I don't think it is, but I don't think anyone would stop you.
There it is.
That's much about Philadelphia,
We clearly actually. Need to do that this summer.
Yes, I love it. So, Joy, we've been doing this cookbook club now for about 6 months, and it's been an interesting endeavor, but I think we've both decided that it's time to do a little bit of reevaluating our plan, right?
We really appreciate those of you that have been into this with us, and, you know, we're... First time podcasters here on Local Mouthful. I'm not this episode, but definitely this project. And we're feeling it out as we go.
And so this was a trial. And we're deciding that we're going to sort of change the plan halfway through.
And our new plan is?
So instead of trying to focus on one book a month, we're going to do one book every 2 months. Just because we found that the rate of cooking became a little too hard for us personally. And we additionally didn't really feel like we were having a chance to vet the books properly before suggesting them, which is an issue that someone raised to us recently, that they were disappointed in the fact that we had selected the Silver Palette Cookbook and then decided we didn't like it.
Although, you know, just because I don't like it doesn't mean you won't like it.
True enough. And I feel like that is part of the endeavor, but I also don't want to lead anyone astray with poor cookbook choices. So we're just going to try to be a little bit more thoughtful about how we approach it and slow it down a little so that we can really spend more time cooking.
Yeah. And I think in the real world, a month is not really long enough to explore a cookbook.
Especially when you are just two people who have real, you know, jobs and lives. And
multiple other jobs.
Yes. And everything revolves around cooking as it is. So for the rest of this year, I think we're just going to do three more books. And so we're going to do My Kitchen in Rome, Vegetable Literacy, and Choosing Sides.
Right. And Rome will be summer.
Yeah.
Vegetable Literacy will be fall. And Choosing Sides will be for the holidays, basically.
Yeah, because it's a great book for potlucks and holiday meals, because it's all about side dishes.
And if you have cookbooks that you want to visit or revisit, you could make recommendations to us. We're all ears.
Yeah.
We'll probably try, you know, here we are in the middle of 2016. We like doing this podcast. We're probably going to keep doing it. And as we go into 2017, we'll be more planned / prepared for the year than we were this year, you know, because as I mentioned, we're kind of just baby podcasters getting our getting our podcast legs going.
We're figuring it out as we go along, and sometimes we're not doing it perfectly.
I mean, really, we're just two girls that love cookbooks. Honestly, like, even though we cook for a living, we still have the same feeling about cooking from new cookbooks that you probably do, as somebody that's just into cooking. It's just fun for us. And, you know, we can't promise that every person is going to love every cookbook, but it is a lot of fun to get to know them, I think.
I totally agree. And I really feel like I have discovered some great things in the books we have focused on so far this year. Absolutely. I loved the Indian book we did. And what was the first book of the year?
I think it was The New Persian Kitchen. And I'm still making those beet burgers once a month. They're so good.
And we did the Lucky Peach book. Which,
and the dumplings.
Yeah.
Not just the dumplings. There's also that clay pot chicken recipe that I've been doing in the Instant Pot.
Yeah.
And I think there's other ones in there, too, that I still like.
So we've really already taken away so much, and it's brought a lot to our own personal repertoires. And that was really the intent, the goal of exploring cookbooks.
It's so easy to fall into a rut with your own cooking. We've talked about this so many times.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you really turn yourself over to a cookbook author, you discover things. Like, there were definitely things in The New Persian Kitchen that I didn't think I was going to like that I really loved.
Absolutely.
That lamb meatball sauce is like tomato paste and water. I thought that was going to be gross, but it was delicious.
Yeah, I feel like I've really benefited a lot. And even, you know, so we had our conversation about the Silver Palette Cookbook. I've now made the olive tapenade, sort of my versions of it, mm-hmm. using their recipe as a starting point several times, and have been so happy with it, mm-hmm. just as something to keep in the refrigerator and
right.
spread on, you know, a piece of toast for lunch and call it good. So yeah. It's been a really interesting, great ride. So it's not going away. It's just going to change a little bit. And we hope that you guys will continue to cook with us and try these remaining three books for 2016.
Indeed. Well, on to sweeter subject.
Yes.
Strawberries.
So we have had a really slow spring in Philadelphia this year. It's been pretty rainy and pretty cool. And I haven't minded that from a weather perspective, but I have minded it from a strawberry perspective, because it meant that we are only now just getting really good local strawberries.
I got my first ones about a week ago.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. And they were so good. I did hardly anything interesting with them. I just ate them.
Yeah. Well, and so this episode will air in a few weeks, but this we're talking in sort of late May now.
I don't even know what time
it is. I guess it is late May.
I don't know.
But so by June, when this episode airs, strawberries should still be in abundance.
Right.
And so we thought it'd be fun to talk about some of the things we love to do with strawberries.
Are you making jam?
Oh my God, yeah. In fact, I have a jar for you.
Really?
I do. So last night, I made a batch of honey-sweetened strawberry vanilla jam.
Ooh.
So it's, you know, all sort of floral and fragrant from the honey, and the vanilla bean is flecked throughout, and the strawberries were really sweet, so it's a good one.
I'm going to have that for lunch. That sounds amazing. I don't make strawberry jam, though perhaps I should. I do love it. But I guess I like it. The fanciest I really get with my strawberries is like putting them on top of brie on toast.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I just like them in yogurt or granola. Berries and granola
are so good.
One of my favorites. I guess I do like them blended up in a smoothie. What else are you doing with them?
I try to make one strawberry pie or strawberry cobbler a season,
mm-hmm.
because Ooh. I love it. It's so good. I recently posted a recipe, my favorite strawberry pie recipe, on my website because I did a blog post all about.
Do you have a photo of it?
I do.
I bet it's mouthwatering.
It's a little overexposed, but it sure looks good.
I'm so into pies. Photos.
I know. So good. I love that pie. And I make jam. I probably make three or four different kinds of strawberry jam each year. So I'll do a strawberry vanilla. I have a recipe in my new book for strawberry cocoa that I've been making a lot of demos, and I love. Strawberry balsamic is also a good one.
Have you ever heard of pickled green strawberries?
I have.
But have you ever done it or tasted it?
I haven't. I have tasted them. I went strawberry picking one year and picked some green strawberries with the intention of pickling them and then didn't do it. I just couldn't get
I'm
to
curious,
it.
I'm curious, but I haven't done it.
They're, you know, green strawberries, they're a little bit astringent.
Yeah.
But beyond that, they're just sort of tart and astringent. So, you know, they're a good foil for that,
mm-hmm.
pickling brine. Although personally, if I'm going to pickle a strawberry, I'd rather have a ripe strawberry and pickle that.
Really?
Yeah.
I have never had that.
So you do it in a sweet brine. So it's vinegar and sugar, and then maybe some either a bay leaf or peppercorns or even juniper berries. And it is, they're really good. Great. They're really, really good.
How about sliced strawberries in salad?
I really love that.
I'm not a fan.
Yeah. My mother hates it. Scott hates it. So it's not something I do for other people, but I really enjoy it.
I think it became popular because it looks so pretty.
Yeah. And I don't love like fruit-based salad dressings. So, but I do love sort of that savory and sweet combination. But when I do it, I do sort of like, I don't put a lot of other savory things. So I'll do like a balsamic dressing and maybe some toasted nuts and then a tangle of baby arugula and some sliced strawberries. And to me, that's pretty delicious.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I do with strawberries besides just eat them is I do sugar them and they sort of like macerate and then they become like, that's really a treat for me.
Those are delicious. And that's actually a great way to freeze them too. Instead of just lining them up on a cookie sheet, if you sugar your berries lightly and then put them into Ziploc bags and freeze them, they hold their quality so much better. So if you find yourself with a lot of them, that's a great way to,
good to know,
preserve them.
I never really get my hands on that many. I don't have your same...
You're not like
ambition for buying like the big flat of something and then
I know.
I admire it.
It's fun.
I want to be like that when I grow up.
Well, you know, you've got a freezer. You could do a flat of berries this year.
I could. How long does it take to like trim up a flat of berries? Be honest.
It's going to take you, especially because local berries are often so much smaller. Mm-hmm. You need to invest at least an hour in the prep. So you get yourself a flat of berries. You rinse them sort of maybe two quarts at a time or, mm-hmm. you know, 3 or 4 pints at a time. And then you work your way through those.
And you take out the top and then do you have them or quarter them?
It's up to you. I mean, you can even just take off the tops and freeze them whole if they're really small. The bigger ones I tend to quarter, but it really just depends on how you want to use them when they're
done. An hour seems like a reasonable investment of time, I guess.
And I will say too, I have in my time, I have probably prepped 1,000 pounds of strawberries on my own over the years. So I am pretty speedy at it. I do like OXO makes a strawberry huller. That's actually,
I was going to ask you, have you used a tool?
I like their strawberry huller. I tend to just do it with a paring knife because I'm crazy. But
you have the huller and you just don't use it?
Yeah.
That's funny.
I like the control that I get from the paring knife better. But the huller is a really good tool.
Why? Do you find that that sometimes wastes good strawberry?
Yeah. And I'm really particular. I try to only pluck out the hull. The other thing to know is when you're working with really good local berries, sometimes you don't even need a tool. You know, you can just use the tip of your fingernail to sort of scrape out the hull, and that's even faster. But the side, you know, the benefit or the downside of that is that you do end up with strawberry stained fingertips. And throughout most of the summer, I go through phases where I have pink fingers from strawberries and then from beets, and then cherries are the worst. So I just expect that my hands are going to be sort of pink at times. It's just the way it is.
It's the mark of the canner.
It is. But I think, Joy, I think you should maybe get a half flat and just do a half flat for your freezer because it is nice to have. And it makes for a really quick dessert later in the year. There's nothing better than finding your local berries in the freezer in September. It's really a treat. So
I do love them on pancakes and waffles.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to mention that.
It's good. Well, if you have any strawberry recipes you love, we'd love to hear them. So make sure to leave us a comment in the show notes and let us know how you are eating your local spring strawberries. And that's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.